Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
It is better to be truthful and good than to not.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen, and not a one of you is prepared for it.
And they are sometimes joined by guests like...
This is Travis.
I had to stop her from screaming.
And Diane.
If you men only knew.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight we're going to talk about Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. This will be the last of the original cast movies and the end of a six-week run for us. It's 1991. The director, Nicholas Meyer.
Nick Meyer, who did 2, 4, and 6.
And he's been involved, I think, in a lot of the writing of this movie, of these movies.
Yeah, he has been. Although Gene Roddenberry was not pleased with his script.
No, and Gene Roddenberry died after he saw the first cut of this movie, but before it was released in theaters, right?
I believe so.
Because I know that it was dedicated for Gene Roddenberry.
Right. Well, because he died by the end.
Well, do you want to just dive into the plot?
Yeah.
We open with Captain Sulu of the USS Excelsior starship, which he's been gunning for the entire time. He's wanted to captain a ship and the Excelsior in particular. And we see a really nice China pattern.
Yeah.
You know, they actually commissioned and did a run of Excelsior China or Federation China.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
It looked very presidential to me, very White House-ish.
Exactly. But the movie starts with a big shockwave coming at the Excelsior, and that's from the explosion of a Klingon moon called Praxis, which is the equivalent to Chernobyl. Such a strong line. This movie is probably about what are we giving it out of 10 scissors? This is probably like a 7 scissors movie.
That's probably about right.
Because, of course, they get a communication from Praxis from somebody as things are just blowing the hell up, screaming about an emergency. But that's interrupted by the Klingon government saying, "Nothing to see here." No, actually, yeah. That's not the
and
right
did you
accent.
Notice it looked like Louis C.K. is the science officer?
I did not, but I'll have to relook at that. That's funny. So they're told, "No, nothing to see here. We're fine. Do not come into the neutral zone. We can handle this."
Which, we didn't just have a huge nuclear meltdown and our reactors not spewing into the atmosphere.
Exactly, which is exactly what happened in Chernobyl. Is the Russian government took days and days to even admit there was anything more than a tiny problem. Now, then we flash to San Francisco, where we have all the Enterprise commanders, except for a conspicuously absent Spock, are called to a high-level classified briefing. We find out why Spock is not with the main group when he's introduced as Federation Special Envoy, and he briefs them on the Klingons' loss of Praxis is the loss of their key energy production facility, and because of the destruction of the Klingon homeworld's ozone layer, everything is crumbling, and the Klingons have basically about 50 years to live as long as they still have to pay for all of their defense. So they are suing for peace, and Spock has been trying to negotiate a peace treaty to end the Cold War.
Now, yeah, again, not a lot of subtlety here.
No,
I mean, this really is about the Cold War.
Oh, yeah. And the Federation people, a lot of them are not happy about a proposed peace treaty. If not the prevailing view, then definitely a dominant view. Well, I don't know, a vocal view is that if the Klingons are in a world of hurt, they should just hurt them, the Federation should hurt them more. and wiped them out while they have the chance, because you can't trust a Klingon. So the idea is that Starfleet is going to send an escort to meet the Klingon Chancellor Gorkon, played by David Warner, who he was the Federation or Terran representative on the Nimbus 3 or something. Yes, the Planet of Galactic Peace. And so he actually gets a nice meaty role in this, David Warner does, and does a nice job. And Starfleet sends the Enterprise, captained by Kirk, because it sends the right message, A, that the Federation means business, that, you know, it's even sending Kirk, who has the most to oppose in this whole thing, since the Klingons murdered his son. And also, it sends a message to the Klingons saying, we'll escort you in, but don't try any shenanigans, because Kirk will take you out.
As if they would trust him.
Yes. Well, and Kirk, he's like, why me? This is not going to help. I will not help matters. And Spock says, oh, no, I vouch for you. And Kirk is like, yeah. You vouch for me? Why? Since when do you vouch for me? And Spock and Kirk have a nice little conversation about how...
We volunteered.
There's an old Vulcan proverb. Only Nixon could go to China.
How could you vouch for me? That's arrogant presumption.
My father requested that I open negotiations.
I know your father's the Vulcan ambassador, for heaven's sake.
But you know how I feel about this. They're animals, Jim.
There is an historic opportunity here.
Don't believe them. Don't trust them.
They are dying.
Let them die.
Well, but you also have Admiral Cartwright's speech.
Scientific programs would be unaffected, Captain, but...
I must protest. To offer Klingons safe haven within Federation space is suicide. Klingons would become the alien trash of the galaxy. And if we dismantle the fleet, we'd be defenseless before an aggressive species with a foothold on our territory. The opportunity here is to bring them to their knees. Then we'll be in a far better position to dictate terms.
So Brock Peters is delivering a speech, which he had a hard time delivering. And so, according to Nick Myers, apparently it took him 3 or 4 takes because he couldn't get it all out. He's like, I gotta stop for a minute. You know, I gotta take a break and then we'll do another sentence, because it was just so abhorrent to him that he couldn't get it all out.
Oh yeah, the Federation are a bunch of racists.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean,
like the Ferguson Police Department.
Oh, the racism in this movie, it is like 9 scissors. You know, they allude to it in the beginning, and that's where the Cartwright character. I mean, we're talking about a black man who has survived the civil rights movement, a man of his age at the time in 1991, having to give the most racist speech.
Yeah.
Literally saying they're going to be the galactic trash.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, I didn't get it at the time, but like on rewatch, I got it. I mean, when I heard, I was like, ooh.
Yeah, it is none too subtle. But it harkens back to the original show. The original show had, the original series had all of those themes running through it. And then we meet Lieutenant Valeris, played by Kim Cattrall.
I did not know that was Kim Cattrall, by the way.
Well, I just kept thinking of her as Samantha.
I've never seen Sex and the City. You know who I thought for a while? I thought it was Phoebe Cates.
Oh, yeah, I could see that.
Like, because I kept thinking, like, she's kind of got that drop-dead Fred kind of Phoebe Cates. And then I finally, when I was looking through the credits and it was Kim Cattrall, I was shocked. Because the dark hair is, I think, what the first thing that threw me. Because it's a pretty good dye job.
If not a flat-out wig.
She really did a good... It was well acted. She really took the role. And so having not known her background, you know, I was pretty impressed when I found out it was her.
Well, and two things, a bit of trivia. She actually posed for pictures on the bridge set with only her Vulcan ears.
And no clothes?
Yes, no clothes at all.
God.
No, they took those pictures and they destroyed them. So you will not be seeing those pictures.
What was why take them?
Well, they took them thinking that they could put them in Playboy or something. But the director and the producer's like, oh, no, you didn't.
Yeah, Paramount would never have tolerated that.
Well, anyway, yeah. So they just took care of that little issue, and that wasn't a problem anymore. But it shows she was Samantha back even then. So the thing about Valeris, actually, I like her as a character because she is, again, she's earnest.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And she is a true believer. And all the way through the story, which has some twist to it, she still is actually, she's a lot more like earnest and honest than a lot of the people in this movie.
She's basically Savick.
Well, yeah, she definitely, we established that we have a Savick problem because she reminds Kirk of Federation procedures as they pull out a space dock.
Yeah.
Which is, basically it just mirrors the same scene when Savick in, it was Wrath of Khan, where they're approached by the Grissom.
Right.
Yeah. So in this case, though, Spock tells her, knock it off. And so she obeys and doesn't bitch anymore. And Kirk is like, not threatened. He's like, ah, lieutenants, Vulcans.
Oh, children, what can you do?
There's a couple other things. Well, one more thing in particular that is weird about Valeris is she is constantly just popping up in scenes.
She's ever present.
Yeah, she just appears around every corner.
Yeah, I suspect they paid a lot of money for her, so they wanted her in every shot. I think it was a little bit of stunt casting.
Maybe. What had she done before, though? Wasn't she the original Mannequin, or am I thinking of somebody else?
She was Emmy in Mannequin. That was in 87.
Yeah, so. She was the Mannequin.
Midnight Crossing, too. Wow. Bonfire of the Vanities.
And these are all before 91?
Yeah. Oh, she was in Wild Palm, that terrible TV miniseries. Big Trouble in Little China was in 86. So, I don't know. I guess she wasn't quite big yet.
But she had enough chops.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's two themes through this movie that I could see from the beginning, and that is the age of the crew is really an issue now. And
oh, yeah. No, I wrote down, like, Shatner alone looks really, really old. And whether or not that was a makeup choice or he's just really, really old, but he looked really, really old.
Well, they've been flirting with the whole age issue before, but now it's like they're both old and they are the older generation. You know, like the whole Klingon peace treaty is going to be the most difficult for their generation because they didn't grow up with blacks in their schools or whatever. So the other thing I noticed is, did you see that on the Enterprise Bridge, they've evidently, between the last two movies, installed a disco ball?
Yeah, you noticed that.
Like, I don't know what that's all about, but it's weird.
Throw right over Kirk's chair.
It's just strange. I mean, we all need a cool nightlight, but still.
I don't know. I don't know what the aesthetic was. They really went all out on some of the set design in this, down to the detail of every label that you see, like all the Starfleet labels on all the equipment, had actual true instructions all the way to the end. So everything was correct as far as the canon.
Oh, that's funny. Well, this is, of course, deep in the middle of Next Generation. So they had some more canon going on. And also, they had a decent amount of money to play with.
Well, I mean, they didn't spend a lot of money, though.
Still less than the first movie, but I think this one did pretty good at the box office, too, right?
The budget was estimated at $30 million. The worldwide gross was $100 million.
Yeah, that's not bad.
No.
It's not quite as big as the first movie, but it didn't cost nearly as much either.
Well, and also by 1991, I mean, there was some Star Trek fatigue. I mean, and after, especially after Star Trek V, they're lucky that they had a Star Trek VI.
Yeah, well, most definitely. But I'm glad they did, because I thought this was kind of fun. There were some goofy parts, but I thought it was fun.
Yeah, there were some cutesy parts and some goofy parts, but it was very ham-handedly typical, cloyingly, morality tale Star Trek, which is what we've come to know and love.
Except that for a morality tale, there's some strange stuff going on.
Oh, there's a lot. There's a lot. There's some definitive contradiction, which I wrote down. So,
well, next we cut to Spock's quarters, where Valeris is actually trying to talk to Spock about something, sort of the perils of negotiating with the Klingons, but Spock totally overtalks her. Spock is not a feminist. Also, is Spock like mixing up a roofie for her?
Yeah, I'm not sure what that whole was, that whole process was, but I wrote down logic, you know? And he's apparently beginning to eschew logic because, you know, she's approaching him, and I think she's giving him the hard sell to try and see if she can convert him to help.
Exactly. No, she is definitely lobbying for her political point, but we don't really notice that at first because she just gets overtalked.
Well, and she just seems really eager. And so she seems like an eager beaver crewman who wants to do all, you know, who knows all the rules and wants to play by all the rules and wants to do all these things. And, you know, kind of how you get when you're at a new job for the first week and like you've learned what you're supposed to do. And so you want to do everything by the book and you want to do everything just that perfect. And what you don't realize is that everybody around you has done the job for 25 years and doesn't appreciate your snotty ass.
Well, that's true. Except that, of course, Spock has taken a special interest in her, even from the Academy.
Yeah, and so that's the other thing. I'm like, so is there some kind of weird Ponfar? You know, is he heat? Is there going to be another space baby? You know, like, I don't know.
Well, I mean, and, you know, it's kind of an inappropriate relationship as far as, like, he's her commanding officer.
Right.
So it's a little dicey.
Well, except, of course, that, again, Kirk comes back as captain.
Yeah, he was demoted for real. So, but still, it's weird. And, of course, Spock is, you know, he's a captain also. He just happens to be playing the envoy role here.
It makes you wonder what Spock's ship was.
Yeah, maybe he was just a captain with no ship.
Yeah.
Doing all this envoy work in the background. Since his singing career with Row, Row, Row Your Boat didn't really take off.
Well, and you would think if Starfleet was going to make him the envoy or the emissary, that they would take him out of rotation and they wouldn't just leave him with a crew and a ship that was just sitting idle.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And, well, did you read or did they talk on the special features about what the first pass of the script has them all kind of coming out of retirement?
Yes.
And those were some cheesy, cheesy coming out of retirement ideas. I'm glad they did not do that.
Yeah. Well, and most of the actors refused.
Oh, yeah.
They're like, we're not, we want this to be our last movie and we want it to be great, but none of our characters would do this.
Oh, yeah. They were having Sulu driving a cab.
Yeah.
And Uhura was having a radio talk show.
Yeah.
And I think Bones was actually drunk in a bar. I don't remember what Chekhov was
doing. That would
not
have been a stretch, probably.
No, that's true. Yeah, that would have been in character, but still. So at least they got a dignified beginning to this movie.
Again, this was another one of those where it got written, and it didn't get rewritten as much as there was just a different script. And then there was a different script, and so it ended up being, well, we like this part of this script, and we like this part of this script, and we like this part of this script.
So it was that same Star Trek IV, Nicholas Meyer melange.
Yeah, exactly. It seems to be that same kind of stitching together pattern, which I think was rather effective in the movie. I mean, it seemed a pretty linear story.
Oh, yeah. It was a couple of different things going on, but yeah, it still worked pretty well. It would have been an excellent two-part TV show, you know?
Sure, yeah.
Because it's got that kind of feel to it, except that you end up having some really fun, great actors and some stunt casting going on.
Yeah.
Anyway, so after Cosby gives Samantha a roofie, we end up at the rendezvous between the Enterprise and Gorkon's battlecruiser. And that's where they're invited to dinner. With that none too subtle, Chekhov quote about guess who's coming to dinner.
Which was originally going to be Nichelle Nichols' line, but she refused.
Yeah, absolutely. She should have.
She was like, no.
So we meet Gorkon in the flesh and Gorkon's daughter and another couple of generals and then General Chang.
The best. I mean, hands down, my favorite character.
Oh, yeah. Christopher Plummer, first of all. He is quoting Shakespeare and chewing scenery. Ugh. And also, General Chang is my favorite. He has my favorite chicken at restaurants. Twice fried. Fantastic. Sometimes a little spicy.
I really loved the Chang character because it was just so over the top ridiculous. And then it was just arrogant and just so steeped in that exactly what you needed, that background of, you know, the Klingon hardcore old school regime, where they get into the quips of, you know, you can't appreciate Shakespeare, until hear it in the original Klingon.
Plus,
I don't know if you know the origin of where that concept comes from.
No, go ahead.
That was a Hitlerism where in the war, Germany propaganda said, you know, you really don't know Shakespeare until you've heard it in the original German.
Apparently, Christopher Plummer doing Shakespeare. At least in one point, I think maybe for like the Toronto Shakespeare Company or something, William Shatner understudied under Christopher Plummer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So Christopher Plummer used that kind of, he tweaked his nose at that.
Awkward.
Funny, though.
I can't imagine Shatner as any kind of Shakespearean character. I can't even, that just wrecks my brain.
Yeah, apparently it wrecked Christopher Plummer's brain too.
Rightly so.
Yeah. But, you know, come on, the dueling egos of Plummer and Shatner.
Oh, but there's no competition there.
Well, ego-wise, though.
I mean, I guess the men against each other, but hands down, the war, that war is over before it ever started.
Of course, yeah.
Now I think I'm remembering Christopher Plummer in Dragnet.
Well, Christopher.
Dan Aykroyd.
Oh, yeah. Tom Hanks, right?
Tom Hanks, yeah.
Oh, yeah. goat fur chaps, I remember at the end of that movie.
Yeah.
Too much fun. So, anyway, the dinner is a fun. There's a lot of speechifying and a lot of racism and a lot of uncomfortable dialogue.
To you, Chancellor Gorka, one of the architects of our future.
Chancellor.
Perhaps we are looking at something of that future here.
Tell me, Captain Kirk, would you be willing to give up Starfleet?
I believe the captain feels that Starfleet's mission has always been one of peace.
Far be it for me to dispute my first officer. But Starfleet has always been
enough.
Fourth.
Captain, there's no need to mince words. In space, all warriors are cold warriors.
General, are you fond of Shakespeare?
We do believe all planets have a sovereign claim to inalienable human rights.
Inalienable? If you could only hear yourselves. Human rights. Why, the very name is racist. The Federation is no more than a Homo sapiens-only club.
Present company accepted, of course.
In any case, we know where this is leading. The annihilation of our culture.
That's not true.
No?
No. To be or not to be?
That is the question which preoccupies our people, Captain Kirk. We need breathing room.
Earth, Hitler, 1938.
I beg your pardon.
Well, I see we have a long way to go.
We must do this again sometime.
You don't trust me, do you? I don't blame you. If there is to be a brave new world, our generation is going to have the hardest time living in it.
There's some terrible blue food, by the way.
Yes.
As you will know if you've heard Kevin Pollak's or read Kevin Pollak's book, and he talks about why you never as an actor, you have the long, long exposition when you have food, but you never actually put anything in your mouth. Because as food related tables are filmed in films, because everybody has to have a scene shot in a different segment, you have to replicate your eating of that item that you ate 20, 25, 30 times.
Yeah, I so think...
If you put anything in your mouth once, you're going to put it in your mouth 30 times. And so but Nick Meyer really wanted them to go for the food, and nobody wanted the blue food. Nobody wanted it because they were like, it looks unnatural, it looks terrible, it's unhealthy. And Nick Meyer said, you know what, anybody who takes a bite, I'm $20 a bite out of my pocket.
Oh, that's funny.
The only person who took him up on it, would you care to guess?
Well, that Klingon guy did.
Well, but I mean, consistently through all the takes, and then actually went after Nick Meyer for the money.
Oh.
Not the obvious. I mean, just think obvious.
Just Shatner?
Yes.
Oh, that's funny. I was going to go Plumber, but
yeah.
No, of course.
Soaked him for $3,400. Made him pay up.
That is funny stuff. Well, I know Larry Miller, the comedian Larry Miller, has a story about the first time he was eating on a film set. He wasn't going to use like a spit bucket because he's like, oh, that's just gross. Don't, you know, I can't imagine. But then he ended up eating like 3 meals worth of food during a scene. And every time after that, he's like, yes, please. I need my bucket here. Because you don't swallow anything, because you're right. Every time you know, if you have to shoot it 30 times, you're going to eat 30 bites of food.
Yeah, and that assumes you get everything on the first take.
Yeah, exactly. So it's chewing, spitting. Chewing, spitting. It's a heck of a way to make a living, I'm sure, but still. But at the end of the meal, they bid fond farewell to their Klingon guests. And immediately sort of collapse in how stressful it was. And they start kibitzing between each other, including, I love the fact that like Uhura, like sort of collapses on the transporter, like pod or whatever the stage.
Yeah, the transporter pad.
Yeah.
Transporter
and then pad. Like takes off her shoes, you know, I mean, that's like a total like after party sort of thing.
Exactly.
And everybody knows that they didn't really behave themselves too well. So much so that, you know, Kirk has this nice long captain's log, and he mentions that Romulan ale will no longer be served at diplomatic functions.
Yeah, and mentions that he doubts that their behavior will give them any kind of distinction in history.
Exactly. Well, later that night, problems happen because the Enterprise appears to fire 2 photon torpedoes at the Klingon ship, which disables the artificial gravity. And during all that confusion, 2 figures wearing Starfleet suits and gravity boots beam aboard the Klingon ship and grievously wound Gorkon before beaming away. What do you think of these special effects, by the way?
So I thought the special effects were pretty good, with exception of the Pepto-Bismol blood.
Yeah, I thought the blood color was bad, but they had...
And it was.
That I know they had to differentiate the blood colors.
Why did they have to differentiate the blood colors?
Well, because when you had to find the blood on the suits later, on the Enterprise, you had to know it was Klingon blood.
I don't think you did. I don't think that was necessary. I think the audience would have been smart enough to figure that out. Because in the canon of the series, Klingon blood is red. But I will point out that this is the first time that they'd used any CGI. So that was all CGI effect.
Oh, yeah. And like I like the effect of the blood in zero gravity.
Yeah. And so that was all studied from NASA footage and fluid dynamics from NASA.
Which is pretty great. But I've got a question.
The rest of those effects, the weightlessness and all that, though, They did some pretty sophisticated, old school rigging to get that kind of you know, where they would invert people on a plane, and then they would make them, they would, so the, where the Klingon, two, where the two Klingon duty officers in the hallway are shot and they appear to be floating away backwards, they're actually being, they're being propelled, or they're being ascended up through a pulley system. Mm. And because the wires are behind them, you don't see the wires.
Well, that makes sense.
That's... But so there was a lot of, there was a lot of that kind of old school, kind of just old school, hardcore, good movie making, you know, effects.
Yeah. Practical effects mixed with CG, which is the way it should be.
Right. Cause I'm sorry. I mean, and I like technology as much as anybody, but even still, you can tell when something's CGI and when something's not. Now it's getting a lot better. I will make a brief tangent. I will say that, probably the, some of the best CGI I've seen so far is Guardians of the Galaxy. It's got some pretty amazing CGI.
Well, I have yet to see it, but I hear good things.
Yeah, I've seen it probably like a dozen times now.
Oh, fun. Well, maybe we should talk about Guardians of the Galaxy at some point.
Anytime you want. I don't have to watch it again. I will, of course, but...
Well, okay, the other thing I had, comment I made in my notes was, boots as an important plot element. Have they learned nothing from Star Trek V?
No.
And I swear they're the same boots.
Oh, I'm sure they're the same boots.
It's craziness.
Why would they? No, the prop master. Are you kidding? It's like, God, we spent like $700 for these ski boots that nobody uses here. Check them out again.
Exactly. So the Klingons, of course, are freaking out because they've been attacked.
Oh. Yeah, well, I mean, their ship was boarded and invaded.
Yeah, exactly. And an assassination attempt. Well, it's going to be an assassination of their ambassador. And they're going to come about and they're going to blast the hell out of the Enterprise. But Kirk solves the problem the only way he can, and in a way that surprises everybody on board the Enterprise, at least. He surrenders.
Yeah, but doesn't surprise the audience.
No. So he surrenders and beams aboard the Klingon ship with Dr. McCoy to try to save Gorkon's life. Now, McCoy says, hey, I'm going, because they need a doctor. And Spock wants to go, but Kirk's like, no, I'm the captain, I'm going. Besides, you've already pissed me off enough vouching for me earlier.
Yeah.
So, Kirk and the doctor go to save Gorkon's life, although, as it turns out, this is not a great choice because McCoy doesn't know anything about Klingon anatomy.
And may in fact still be drunk.
Well, they're all perhaps still drunk. That becomes a problem later too. So they get aboard, and despite their best attempts, including some old school MASH type chest compressions, Gorkon dies. You know, his last words are, don't let it end this way. But still, it's pretty bad. Things are kind of in the shit.
By the way, that's pretty un-Klingon.
Oh, yeah. No. Gorkon's the hero of this whole story.
Yeah, except that Gorkon wouldn't have known that Kirk wasn't responsible. I mean, he would have, there was no evidence. So, anyway.
Yeah, well, it's true. And Kirk has not been a big fan of the Klingons generally. So, you know. But this is where the fun casting of this movie comes, because we cut to the Federation president's office. I did not recognize who the Federation president was at first.
Didn't you? I did instantly. I knew who it was.
The president is Kurtwood Smith, Red Foreman from that 70s show.
Yeah.
Dressed as Dog the Bounty Hunter.
Kind of, yeah.
But do you know who the Klingon...
He's the best mustache.
Oh, yeah. Well, do you know who the Klingon ambassador was?
The Klingon ambassador was?
Yeah. Like, when you first cut to the scene, you see the Klingon ambassador discussing the whole thing about how they're going to try Kirk, and
he looks really familiar, but I couldn't place him.
Okay. I had to look him up because he looks so familiar.
He's been in tons of stuff.
Yes. His name is John Shuck. I think he is a national treasure, and he starred, I think, the earliest memory I have of him, and I think Terry is the one that reminded me of this series. But do you remember the series Holmes and Yo-Yo?
What? I'm sorry?
There was a series called Holmes and Yo-Yo. And nope. John Chuck plays Yo-Yo. And it is like two detectives. One is like a Peter Falk type character. And the other, or a Columbo type character. And the other is John Chuck, who gets injured in sort of a RoboCop type thing. And so he comes back as kind of a half robot. And the most distinguishing feature is when he, I think, like his computer brain will come out with an answer and a Polaroid will come out of his mouth. Like a Polaroid photo where you have to like shake it, I think, too. Or maybe it came out of his like jacket pocket. But anyway, also, and I do not remember this show, but there was a 1996 TV show called The Last Frontier. Obviously, somehow about Alaska. And the episode he was in, the title of which, A Little Night Usik.
Oh, God.
And for those...
Nobody outside of Alaska is going to get that.
Yeah, those unfamiliar with the term Usik.
I've had to explain this, by the way.
Yeah.
I've embarrassingly had to explain this to people that I work with.
Well, it's a serious thing. It is the bony penis of a walrus. Like, I think dogs are like this too, but there's actually like a penis bone, unlike humans. Yeah. Anyway, in Alaska and probably other First Nations places, the natives will like carve things out of usiks and make like scrimshaw into usiks and stuff.
Yeah.
So A Little Night Usik is kind of funny as a title.
It's funny if you get it.
Well, I love the pun.
Of course you do, because you are powerless to the pun.
I am powerless.
And also, since we're talking about Alaska, you know, large portions of this movie were shot in Alaska.
Yes. Yeah. The whole Rurapente is shot just outside of Anchorage, actually. Yeah, pretty cool stuff. So the Klingon ambassador says this is an unprovoked attack, and Kirk was arrested for the crime, and nothing there is in dispute. So they're going to stand trial for the assassination of Chancellor Gorkon. And the Federation president is like, no, we're not going to do this, and turns to Sarek to say, hey, Ambassador Sarek, you know, come on, get me out of this. And Sarek is like, legally speaking, they're doing the right thing.
Yeah. Thanks for the help, asshole.
Yes. And then we have the shifty-eyed Romulan ambassador, Nanklus, who is like a shifty-eyed Indian subcontinent or maybe Middle Eastern kind of guy just thrown in because we want to have some real racism with our fake Klingon racism.
The only thing more lacking racism here is if he would have had a towel over his head.
Exactly, yes. So then, after the president talks to the ambassadors, he is then briefed. By the way, this briefing is not in the theatrical release of this movie. If you wonder why René Auberjonois is not listed in the cast, it's because he wasn't in the theatrical release.
Oh, well, he wasn't, and I don't have the briefing.
You don't have the briefing?
It wasn't. It wasn't in my copy of the movie.
Okay. At the end, during the assassination scene, at basically, this will be our second or third assassination attempt, like mentoring candidate style.
Mm-hmm.
Was René Auberjonois in that?
It's Benoit, by the way.
Sorry.
No, he wasn't.
So there wasn't like a Scooby-Doo moment at the end of the movie that you saw?
Nope.
Oh. Well, let me just point out, when we get there, he comes back later.
Okay.
So, the next thing is we go back to the Enterprise, where people are perplexed. And what happens when people are perplexed? Vulcans start proposing throwing wooden shoes into the Enterprise's communication machinery.
Yes, this is the sabotage.
Yes. So, that was kind of weird. But it's an effective scene, but it is kind of weird how all of a sudden the Vulcan is going to teach all the members of the crew on the 23rd century a word that is should be fairly common.
Well, I think she was trying to do it to show her superior wit and intellect.
Perhaps, yes.
And she didn't want to outright tell them that sabotage was something she would do. She was just retelling a historical event of color.
There you go. Well, yeah, because she has learned from Spock, her mentor, at least what she can remember of those lessons, because, whew, there's a lot of memory missing, I bet. You know, logic, truth. Come on, don't be such a stick in the mud. Relax a little, Valeris. Unbutton some of those top buttons. So
take off your Cosby sweater.
Exactly. Yeah. Come on, loosen up. Have some Jell-O pudding. So Gorkon's daughter becomes a new chancellor, and continues diplomatic negotiations. Although she is, of course, very tense because her father has just been killed. And
well, aboard his own ship. I mean, if you can't even hide on your own ship and be safe, then where are you going to go?
Well, it's true. No, it's not great. It's you know, she has legitimate reasons. And then we get to the trial scene, because we have a couple things going on now. We have on the board of the Enterprise, we have a Sherlock Holmes kind of thing going on, and
yeah,
in Klingon land, we have a courtroom drama.
A pretty fantastic scene, by the way.
Oh, it's great. First of all, let me just point out that the judge is a Skeksis.
Yeah, he is.
As much as Spock was Jim, the Gelfling, in Star Trek III, the judge is a Skeksis in the Klingon world.
Yeah, I would agree.
And the who is the counselor for the defense?
Young Worf.
Well, no. Worf's ancestor.
Yeah, it's Michael Dorn.
Yes, it is. It's actually Michael Dorn who plays Worf. But I think they were not suggesting it was young Worf. They were suggesting that it was like Grandpa Worf.
Yeah, well, then that would make sense. This is where I had a problem with the dialogue.
Well, so, okay, wait, hold on. Let me point out something first. As much as I like the transition scene on Hunt for Red October, when they go from Russian to English, I love the transition scene in this movie where they go from Klingon to English.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
But it's really subtle, actually.
It is. It's great.
Yeah. No, they did a really good job. And that set, that courtroom set is such a great set. It was really, I mean, it was amazing.
There we have it, citizens. We have finally established the particulars of the crime.
And now we come to the architect of this tragic affair. James Tiberius Kirk.
What would your favorite author say, Captain? Let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings. Tell us your sad story, Kirk.
Tell us that you plan to take revenge for the death of your son.
That's not true.
Objection! Captain Kirk has not been identified as the assassin.
Sustained.
I offer into the record
this excerpt from the captain's personal log.
I've never trusted Klingons. And I never will. I've never been able to forgive them for the death of my boy. Never trusted Klingons, and I never will. I've never been able to forgive them for the death of my boy.
Are those your words?
Those words were spoken by me.
Objection! My client's political views are not on trial.
On the contrary! Captain Kirk's views and motives are indeed at the very heart of the matter. This officer's record shows him to be an insubordinate, unprincipled, career-minded opportunist with a history of violating the chain of command whenever it suited him.
Continue.
Indeed, the record shows that Captain Kirk once held the rank of Admiral, and that Admiral Kirk was broken for taking matters into his own hands in defiance of regulations of the law. Do you deny being demoted for these charges? Don't wait for the translation! Answer me now!
I cannot deny it.
You were demoted?
Yes.
For insubordination?
On occasion, I have disobeyed orders.
And were you obeying or disobeying orders when you arranged the assassination of Chancellor Gorkon?
I didn't know about the assassination until we boarded the ship.
You still deny the Enterprise fired on Cronus One?
Well,
your honors, please!
And you still deny your men beamed aboard and shot the Chancellor?
Objection!
I cannot confirm or deny actions I did not witness.
Captain Kirk, are you aware that as the captain of a starship, you are required to be responsible for the actions of your men?
I am.
Then if it should be proved that members of your crew did, in fact, carry out such an assassination...
Jim, they're setting us up. Your honors!
Do not answer!
Captain Kirk, you will answer the question.
As captain, I am responsible for the conduct of the crew under my command.
Your honors, the state rests.
Yeah, okay, so now, tell me about the dialogue problems.
So, when they're bringing up Kirk's history and they're kind of foreshadowing, when Chang is foreshadowing, he says, you know, that Kirk is insubordinate and career-oriented. Both of those things can't be true. He can't be both insubordinate and career-oriented.
Yeah, but you have to admit that Chang has a lot more grasp on Kirk's history than, say, the other admiral in Star Trek III.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Also, I love the Adlai Stevenson moment. The Cuban Missile Crisis moment where Chang tells Kirk not to wait for the translation.
Yeah. Yeah.
I found the actual clip from the UN Security Council meeting where Adlai Stevenson said that, and I'm dropping it in.
Let me ask you one simple question. Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation. Yes or no?
That's awesome.
Yeah, well, we definitely heard stories about the Cuban Missile Crisis from our mom, especially, because Anchorage was a top target of a first strike nuclear attack or a retaliation attack.
As we've discussed before, all of that very much, you know, that Cuban Missile Crisis and the Cold War in Russia and First Strike and then, of course, that terrible Day After movie did nothing but, you know, terrorize my childhood.
I wonder if
some kind of strange subconscious paranoia that has caused me to hoard food to this day.
Well, by the way, to tangent off slightly, I have a proposal. Obviously, 13 days or whatever it's called in October.
It's just called 13 days.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. We should definitely add that to our list along with JFK. But I have two proposals. One is we should probably do the Day After.
Yeah, I watched it about a year and a half ago.
Does it hold up?
No, it's terrible.
Okay, well, we can do that. Also, how familiar are you, or are you willing to tackle The Phantom of the Paradise? Have you heard of it?
I don't know.
It's kind of a rock version of Phantom of the Opera in the 70s with all the music written by Paul Williams.
Paul Williams?
Yes. Rainbow Connection and all. Okay.
Wow.
If you're willing, we need to do that. It's like a Rocky Horror kind of thing. It's called Phantom of the Paradise.
74.
And I know you're a Phantom of the Opera fan.
I'm a huge Phantom of the Opera fan, but this Brian De Palma.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a serious movie. It's like a cult movie. How serious? It's a serious movie like Rocky Horror is a serious movie. It may not hold up well. It may not be.
Serious movie Rocky Horror serious movie or a serious movie Shock Treatment serious movie?
Well, we're going to find out, I hope.
Yeah. Wow, Paul Williams.
Have you heard interviews with Paul Williams recently?
No.
He's just wrote a book, and I think he's got like a self-help program that he's talking about, because he just basically kicked all of his addictions, but it took him however many years. And he talks about, he's like got like a biographer with him, I think, when he does these interviews. But he talks about how, you know, he was a mess, but he was also kind of a certain kind of music star, king of the world too. You know, he wrote a bunch of Carpenter songs and Three Dog Night songs, and who else? He wrote a David Bowie song that was popular. So, but he also did all the drugs.
Yeah, he's the television equivalent of Keith Richards.
Kinda, yeah. But he also wrote Rainbow Connection, and he wrote the theme to The Love Boat.
Well, he was also on The Love Boat, like.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, he was 5'2", but spunky as all get out.
Yeah, I mean, he was on, I remember seeing him in little cameo roles in TV growing up, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
In one where he played a vampire, I think.
I'm telling you, Phantom of the Paradise, we have to investigate.
He was the composer for The Boy in the Plastic Bubble.
Awesome.
I made a reference to that, and nobody remembers that movie.
The TV movie with John Travolta?
Exactly. You remember it.
I totally remember it.
You and I are the only two people.
Somebody tell you. Yeah. Boy in the Plastic Bubble, Paul Williams. Fantastic. So if you're, the other thing I was going to ask is, how do you feel about ants? The insect.
How do I feel about ants?
How would you feel about watching a movie that is predominantly ants?
Probably not. Why?
It's pretty great.
What movie?
It's called Phase 4, and it is one of the most stylish movies. It's a little wacky in the plot, but...
Wacky.
But let me tell you, it is amazingly stylish.
1974?
Are you looking at Phase 4? Yeah. Who is it? Saul Bellow? Is that the director?
Saul Bass.
Yeah, Bass or Bates, yeah. He was also, I think, one of the directors of photography for Alfred Hitchcock, like, during Psycho.
Wow.
And he did a bunch of that kind of stuff for Hitchcock. Really, really super stylish. The acting, I think there's only three actors in the whole thing, and they're not great, and the story's a little weird. But the fact that he gets serious drama out of ants is amazing. And we're not talking about like 50s radioactive 50-foot ants. We're talking about just plain ants.
Oh, boy.
It's both creepy but I think it's really kind of powerful. I wasn't sure what I was going to get. And I watched it late at night on a tablet in bed, so I thought I was going to get the heebie-jeebies from all the ants. But it was so well done. It was great. The ants are like menacing without being creepy crawling menacing.
So this isn't like that cockroach movie.
Oh, no, because, yeah, I mean, it's so much more than that. It's very interesting. It's worth watching, if nothing else. Don't go buy it because I already did. But,
All right. Okay. I will avail myself of it. We should at some point probably go back and just watch a whole bunch of bad 70s movies.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because like I watched The Omega Man when I was in Alaska a couple of years ago, and which is Charlton Heston.
Yeah,
and
I don't have. I've never seen it, so it'd be fun.
It's a takeoff on. It's not a takeoff. It's supposed to be a loose adaptation of I Am Legend.
Yeah, The Last Man on Earth. Because have you seen the Vincent Price Last Man on Earth?
I haven't.
Yeah, see, that is really. We should do a Last Man on Earth / Omega Man multicast.
And then we can follow it up with I Am Legend. I'm so disappointed by that movie.
I would be interested in watching it again because I was so disappointed because I had read the book and I thought it was fantastic, and the movie had almost nothing to do with the book.
Yeah, it is like the World War Z.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the book, even still, is a fantastic book. It really is. And I got it on audiobook, which was even more haunting because then you had the voice actor, you know, Neville.
Oh, yeah.
Which was just the creepy as hell.
Okay,
here, when I'm trying to listen to it in bed.
Yeah, I recommend both the book on audio, but I also recommend the graphic novel. There's an I Am Legend graphic novel that is really good and gives you the same kind of, you know, the whole thing is relentless. But you know, the Vincent Price movie actually is quite faithful to the story.
Yeah, the Omega Man is not.
Ah, well, it's right in the tradition then of the I Am Legend Will Smith movie. So.
The Bathurst novel, it's a great book. It really is.
Oh, and it's got that twist. It's got that wonderful, you know, it explains its title only at the very end.
Yeah, it makes the title meaningful, at which point the title of the movie has nothing to do with the movie.
Exactly.
It makes no sense at all in the movie. That was my biggest contention. I was so angry. It just made me so mad.
Well, for such a visually pleasing movie, though.
Oh, it was a pretty movie, but again, World War Z was a pretty movie.
Yeah, true.
You know, it had good effects. It had good zombie effects, except, you know, that you know, they didn't follow any of the damn canon because the zombies can magically run.
Well, not only that, but they could also, at least in the one of the trailers, they could swarm into a gigantic hand that bats a helicopter out of the sky.
Yeah, there was all kinds of...
Okay, so
bring it back in.
Back to Star Trek. Back, take it back. So, while several senior Starfleet officers want to rescue Kirk and McCoy, the Federation president says, no, we can't risk full-scale war.
And well, yeah, I think you skipped past the, you know, they were basically the sham trial.
Oh,
and the,
sorry.
Them yes. being summarily just like, you know, in the interest of the peace talks and the furthering of the peace and goodwill, that their sentence of death is commuted and they're just on rural repente.
On the Flozen? The sentence to live imprisonment on the Flozen asteroid of rural repente.
Marriage.
My name, Jose Jimenez.
How do you do, sir? May we have your name?
My name, Jose Jimenez.
You're the chief astronaut with the United States Interplanetary Expeditionary Force?
I am the chief astronaut. With the United States Interplanetary. My name is Jose Jimenez.
Mr. Jimenez, could you tell us a little about your spacesuit?
Yeah. It's very uncomfortable.
How much did the spacesuit cost?
That spacesuit cost $18,000.
$18,000?
Yeah.
That seems rather expensive.
Well, it has two pair of pants. So that's only $9,000.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I've been noticing this, Mr. Jimenez. What is this called? A crash helmet?
Oh, I hope not.
What are the physical qualities that they look for in an astronaut?
The physical quality they look for in the astronaut. You got to have the perfect hearing. You got to have the perfect vision. You got to have the normal blood pressure. You got to have four legs.
You have to have four legs?
Yeah, they were going to send a dog, but they thought that would be too cruel.
Mr. Jimenez, you must have some opinions on the race for space.
All right, I will. I got one.
Good. What do you think of Vanguard 1 and Jupiter 2?
That was a pretty close game. I thought for sure the Vanguard was going to take it.
It was close, yes.
What you were reading the papers about.
I know. Now tell me, Jose.
I'll tell you, Jose.
Tell me.
Yes, I'll tell you. You just ask me and I tell you.
All right. Were you a participant at any of the rocket launchings at Cape Canaveral?
I will a potato bun. I need the rocket launch. The Cape Canaveral. I was there when they opened the door into the nose cone. They took that mouth and they put that mouth inside the nose cone. Then they closed the door on that little mouth. I don't want to talk about it.
Oh, Mr. Mendes, please. Please, let's try to continue here. I want to ask you, what is the most important thing in rocket travel?
To me, the most important thing in the rocket travel is the blast off.
The blast off.
I always take a blast before I take off. Otherwise, I wouldn't get in that thing.
Well, after that, what is the procedure in taking off?
The procedure after that in taking off, mm-hmm. You got to put on a set-up hydraulic double dynamo reversible booster. You got to activate the decompression activator. And you got to put on the anti-magnetic degaussing system.
And then you're really up there.
No, that opens the door. And lets out that little mouth.
More racism. That's really what we needed to interject into this movie.
Anyway, they are found guilty and sentenced to life imprisonment on the frozen asteroid Rurapente. And during the trial, it's great because Chang trashes McCoy as being incompetent and drunk. And then he uses Kirk's own words against him. And then back to Starfleet. Several senior Starfleet officers want to rescue Kirk and McCoy, but the Federation president doesn't want to risk full-scale war. And Ezetbur, is that the female's name? The new chancellor?
I have no idea.
It's Gorkon's daughter?
Yeah.
She refuses to invade Federation space, saying that only Kirk and McCoy will pay her for her father's death. In the meantime, Spock plays Sherlock Holmes aboard the Enterprise, and Samantha vaporizes a bowl in the kitchen as they hunt for boots.
Yeah, and okay, so this is... I have a problem with this. So, first of all, why are there weapons in the galley?
Well, emergency weapons, right?
Yeah, but no, you got knives. You really need phasers? Like, seriously, someone's going to invade you? Is somebody going to invade your kitchen to steal your... I mean, if they're going to invade your ship, they're not going to the galley. Okay, but that's one thing. But second of all, there's suddenly all this giant computer console equipment designed just to disable the alarms in the event somebody would shoot a phaser in the galley.
Well, it furthers the plot, and that's about
all. That seems awfully intricate. I'm just saying.
Yeah, well. So, Kirk and McCoy arrive at Rurapente, and which are mines, and they are befriended by a David Bowie wife.
You and I both went to the same time.
Yes, we did. Yes. Okay, I'm sorry. So they were befriended by who?
David Bowie's wife.
Yes. Martia.
And her blunt.
Yes, exactly. So, and Kirk smokes too. It's amazing.
Yeah. So I had a question. Did the mines kind of look to you like kind of Mad Maxian?
Oh yeah. Yeah, it was a little like TV show, original series TV show.
Yeah, it kind of looked like a little Mad Max in, and then there was also this very much DeForest Kelly's Bones' Lethal Weapon 3 months before retirement bitch over and over and over again.
Yes, well, he's a Whinger, remember that. And then Kirk has to fight an alien twice his size. An alien with an excellent mask, but a very identifiable rubber mask. It was pretty, but you could see, like, the eye holes and the makeup underneath.
Well.
Yes, but that's where Kirk ends up kicking him in the knee. Oh, wait.
But not the knee.
That was not his knee.
You all right, Jim?
I think so.
They'll respect you now.
That's a comfort. I was lucky that thing had knees.
That was not his knee. Not everybody keeps their genitals in the same place, Captain.
Anything you want to tell me?
And it's all this crazy flirting between Shatner and Iman. So Martia offers them an escape route. Now, in the meantime, aboard the Excelsior, Captain Sulu is awakened by a crew member who merely wishes to pump up the volume.
Well done.
Thank you. Why is Christian Slater in this movie?
It's just a cameo. I'm guessing that he wanted to be in it because somebody was friends with somebody, clearly.
His mom is a casting director.
Oh, that would explain it.
Which is so fine.
Nepotism alive and well.
Well, you know, he's a fan and his mom's a casting director, so hey, why not? I mean, it worked.
Yeah.
So back to the escape. They have all this shape-shifting escape things. And then did Kirk sleep with this alien?
No. She kisses him and runs off.
Okay. Because Bones is ribbing him about it. And once she changes shape.
Well, okay. And so here's the thing I have about shapeshifters. When she shapeshifts, she can magically shapeshift her clothing too.
Yeah, that's a problem. Well,
yeah.
Okay. Also, if you fire your phaser on a bowl full of space mashed potatoes, why does it only vaporize the bowl and not the mashed potatoes inside? Because wouldn't it just vaporize your clothing if it hit a person then?
Yeah, or wouldn't it turn your skin inside out and you would just be like the inverse transporter from Galaxy Quest?
Yeah, exactly. So, anyway.
I know. There's a lot of little elements like this.
But as Spock would mention in this movie, logic, logic, logic. Who needs logic? Just go with it.
Exactly.
And then in one of the more goofy and yet perfect moments in this, when we determined that Martia's escape is just a ruse to make their deaths appear accidental.
Yeah.
She just transformed into his double and Kirk gets to fight against Kirk.
So Nick Meyer was worried that Shatner would really not think this was funny. Everybody was paranoid that Shatner was going to think this was terrible and not funny. And Shatner thought this was the best part of any of the movies he's ever done.
Of course. And the dialogue is great because it is making fun.
No, and it's all about him.
Yeah.
I'm like, what would he not like about this?
It talks about it in there that this is exactly what Kirk's wanted to do this whole time.
Exactly.
Yeah. If he could actually have sex with himself, too, that'd be perfect.
Oh, you had to go there.
Well, we're not going to talk about that. So.
Oh, that's just.
In the meantime, we have a little bit more of ridiculousness. The Enterprise is flying, and they have to go past a Klingon listening post, and they have to translate Klingon on the fly.
Yeah. Except, again, this is a big plot point. Uhura is the communications officer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
so
you think.
Her knowledge of Klingon should be a little rudimentary, if not more. Plus, in Star Trek... Star Trek 3. She already was doing some Klingon.
Oh, yeah. Well, and they acted in this movie as if this is the first time Klingons have ever been aboard the Enterprise or at dinner with the Federation. Klingons are always, like, hanging around the Federation stuff. In fact, after, what, 4, they were smoking and joking, right?
Yeah. I mean, first they get immolated and blown up. And
wait, it was after 5, rather.
Exactly. I mean, 5 was the peace offering.
Exactly, yeah. But anyway, so we're not going to have continuity errors between the movies. But, of course, once the Enterprise gets in range, and, of course, they're out of the Rurapente force field or whatever, the prison warden is just about to reveal who set them up. But Kirk and McCoy get beamed aboard the Enterprise before that happens, which is... actually sort of fun.
Is this before or after Scotty finds the
in my notes, at least, it's a little before, because in my next paragraph of note says,
oh, I wonder if we wrote down the same thing.
Oh, let's find out. Well, okay, you first then.
I wrote Scotty is dead hearing the rattle in the car.
Yeah, I put Scotty hears a rattling noise and takes out a gum wrapper to silence it, but instead finds uniforms.
Yeah, I know.
Exactly like our father.
I know. The parallel is hilarious.
Oh, it is. And
just
of course, Scotty
wraps it up and shoves it in the door panel.
Well, and of course, Scotty is somewhat obsessed. He is sitting there at whatever that room was, just reading through the Enterprise, like, repair manuals.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they find the two assassins dead, but Kirk and Spock trick their accomplice into believing they're still alive. And so when the culprit tippy-toes into sickbay to finish off the assassins, Kirk and Spock discover that the killer is Valeris.
Yeah. And this is where we get some good mind-rapey action.
Oh, my God, it is. He, at Kirk's request, I'm going to point this out. At Kirk's request, Spock waterboards Samantha's brain.
I did not fire. You cannot prove anything.
Yes, I can. At my trial, my personal log was introduced as evidence against me. How long did you wait outside my quarters before I noticed you?
You knew? I tried to tell you, but you would not listen.
Neither of us was hearing very well that night, Lieutenant. There were things I tried to tell you about having faith.
You have betrayed the Federation. All of you.
And what do you think you've been doing?
Saving Starfleet. Klingons cannot be trusted. Sir, you said so yourself. They killed your son. Did you not wish Gorkon dead? Let them die, you said. Did I misinterpret you? And you were right. They conspired with us to assassinate their own chancellor. How trustworthy can they be?
Klingons and Federation members conspiring together.
Who is us?
Everyone who stands to lose from peace.
Names, Lieutenant.
My comrades will make certain all your ship-to-shore transmissions are jammed.
Names, Lieutenant.
I do not remember.
A lie?
A choice.
Spock.
Where is the peace conference? Where is the peace conference?
Not know.
Then we're dead.
I've been dead before. Contact Excelsior. She'll have the coordinates.
I've already got him, sir.
He really does. He just, I mean, because I wrote down, I'm like, ooh, mind rapey. I forgot this part.
Oh, it's rapey as all hell after the roofying.
Yeah, but she sells it.
Oh, she does. It's difficult. I mean, actually, Spock sells it too.
Yeah, but I mean, she's tearing up, and she's, you know, I felt bad for her.
Well, okay, so to quote another podcast, and I will remember its name this time, it's called Mission Log, and it's a Roddenberry podcast, and they're going through every single episode of every single Star Trek thing, including all the movies.
Yeah.
And they had a nice little discussion here that I'll just refer everybody to that Mission Log episode, where they talk about how Spock, as a good officer, should have refused that order. You can't rape somebody for information. It goes against I joked about waterboarding, but it is the ticking time bomb scenario.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Spock commits a war crime.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true.
It's kind of disturbing in 2015.
Yeah. at the time, but I think at the time, you know, earlier, before having being able to look through the eye of history, I think at the time when you're watching the movie, it made sense in the context of the movie, but looking back, you realize just how wrong. But then the same thing is true of all the racism. Cause, you know, when I first saw this movie, it didn't hit me that it was racist. It didn't hit me that this was about the Cold War. It didn't hit me that this was about race relations. You know, it was just subtle enough. It was only a 2 or 3 on the scissor scale. I wasn't developed enough to get it.
Well, I mean, I certainly knew that it was the racist thing because everybody was doing the eye rolls and stuff, but it's the forced mind meld thing that now is particularly touchy. And again, it is a matter of the times we live in. But, and granted, you know, she was already saying, look, you can't prove anything. And Kirk's like, well, I bet we can, Spock.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're
right. The alternative is to shoot her in the knee. You know, I guess that could have worked. Unless she was wearing the fearsome knee armor that is a stainless steel mixing bowl.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but that's the whole thing. The forced mind meld leaves no marks. And so, you know, if there's no marks, is there really a war crime committed?
Oh no, but it crushes both of them. Both the
No. I'm not saying I'm just saying it's that justification. I'm like, you know, if we waterboard them, you know, we don't do them any physical damage, so what's the harm? Oh, I don't know. Maybe never being able to have a towel that's wet on their face again the rest of their life.
Post-traumatic stress forever.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it doesn't leave physical scars like if you broke their kneecaps or pulled out their nails.
Right.
But being the victim of a mind rape, I don't think is just, I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah.
But you're right. She, Kim Cattrall sells it. She does great. So then, what does Samantha tell us? It's a group of Federation Klingon and Romulan officers who plotted to sabotage the peace talks.
Wah, wah.
We have General Chang. We have Admiral Cartwright. And we have Romulan Ambassador Nanklus. And we also have a nice little speech between Kirk and Spock after the mind rape.
Dining on ashes.
You were right. It was arrogant presumption on my part that got us into this situation. You and the doctor might have been killed.
The night is young. You said it yourself. It was logical. Peace is worth a few personal risks. You're a great one for logic. I'm a great one for rushing in where angels fear to tread. We're both extremists. Reality is probably somewhere in between. I couldn't get past the death of my son.
I was prejudiced by her accomplishments as a Vulcan.
Gorgon had to die before I understood how prejudiced I was.
Is it possible that we two, you and I, have grown so old and so inflexible that we have outlived our usefulness? Would that constitute a joke?
Don't crucify yourself. It wasn't your fault.
I was responsible.
For no actions but your own.
That is not what you said at your trial.
As captain of the ship, human beings.
But, Captain, we both know that I am not human.
Spock, you want to know something? Everybody's human.
I find that remark insulting.
Come on, I need you.
That they talk about they're both extremists. And Spock says, is it possible that we too, you and I, have grown so old and so inflexible that we have outlived our usefulness?
So this is, you know, this is basically the search for the nursery home, the nursing home. Because apparently there was a joke going around. David Letterman liked to tell that it was Star Trek VI, the search for Geritol.
Oh, that's funny. I mean, you know, it's a little dated reference to Geritol, but still funny. We know by this point that the torpedoes that struck Gorkon's cruiser did not come from the Enterprise. Instead, they came from a prototype bird of prey that can fire while cloaked. and it was hovering just below the Enterprise at the time of the assassination. So the crew contacts Sulu, who informs him there's a conference, or Sulu tells them where the conference is being held, Camp Khitomer.
Yep.
And both ships head for the talks at maximum warp. She'll fly apart, then fly her apart.
I know. You know, he really got the great role, one of the great roles in this movie.
Oh, he got what he wanted.
Yeah.
He's a little hammy. He can't accuse Shatner of being a little too hammy, because he is pretty hammy in this role.
Yeah, no, and he didn't have to share the spotlight.
Not at all. So as the Enterprise nears the planet, we have this whole cloaked bird of prey moving to intercept, and they can't track the ship's position, so Chang inflicts all this damage on the Enterprise and then switches the Excelsior. But then, at the suggestion of Uhura, who saves the day, Spock and McCoy modify a photon torpedo to home in on the exhaust emissions of Chang's vessel, using equipment originally intended to study gaseous anomalies.
Yeah, except, I know, I'm going to be that guy. The gaseous anomalies were being studied by the Excelsior, not the Enterprise.
I think you have a point.
So, anyway, it was just one of those things that I was like, oh, God.
So, they use the gaseous anomaly tester, the first two smelt it, dealt it method of torpedo hunting, and they find his location and then blast the crap out of the bird of prey.
And not to besmirch Uhura and her inability to speak Klingon, but since when has her all about the mechanics of knowing, you know, the thing has to have a tailpipe?
What, she's been repeating things the computer has said for years.
I guess that's true. Oh, Galaxy Quest. You see now, after watching all those, it just makes Galaxy Quest even funnier.
Oh, it is. Galaxy Quest is brilliant.
It really is.
So they go to Camp Khitomer to the conference, the peace talks, and we have another assassination attempt at a meeting or a rally. And this time, it's Scotty who saves the day by killing the assassin, who has this phaser rifle. And in the version I saw, but not in the theatrical version, I guess not the version you saw, Scotty kills the Klingon guy and rips off the Klingon guy's mask, and it turns out to be Colonel West. Seriously, a Scooby-Doo moment. So he wasn't even a Klingon. He was a Federation officer.
Okay.
And that is so weird.
Yeah, not the version I saw.
Well, and then we have probably, I mean, it's going to be Kirk's last great speech, and it's a good one.
What's happened? What's the meaning of all of this?
It's about the future, Madam Chancellor. Some people think the future means the end of history. Well, we haven't run out of history quite yet. Your father called the future the undiscovered country. People can be very frightened of change.
You've restored my father's faith.
And you've restored my son's.
His speech is met with probably the first intergalactic slow clap. It's fantastic. So then, after having saved the peace talks in the universe again, Enterprise is ordered back to Earth to be decommissioned. Enterprise has been decommissioned for the last six movies. I'm sorry, five movies. The first one it was being commissioned.
I think it's about time we got underway ourselves.
Captain, I have orders from Starfleet Command. We're to put back to space dock immediately to be decommissioned.
If I were human, I believe my response would be, go to hell. If I were human.
Course heading, Captain.
Thank you.
Second star to the right. And straight on till morning.
Captain's log, stardate 9529.1. This is the final cruise of the Starship Enterprise under my command. This ship and her history will shortly become the care of another crew. To them and their posterity will we commit our future. They will continue the voyages we have begun and journey to all the undiscovered countries, boldly going where no man, where no one has gone before.
On the way home, the crew decide, oh, we're just going to take our time.
Yeah. We're just going to take the scenic route.
Yeah. And Captain Spock's like, if I were human, I believe my response would be go to hell if I were human.
Yeah.
And of course, Chekhov says, course heading, Captain.
When did he stop being half human, by the way?
I know. I've been dead before. It's not so bad. and then Chekhov says, course heading, Captain? And Kirk says, Second star to the right and straight on till morning.
So bad.
Well,
like you couldn't have come up with a better line.
No, it's a Shakespeare, isn't it?
But come on, it's so cheesy.
You could not have swung a Romulan cat without hitting a Shakespeare reference in this movie.
Yeah, it's true. So the whole crux of this, the final plot was that it's the existential lady. The whole kind of third plot of this was that it's the existential struggle of, you know, who will I be if I have no enemy to fight?
Well, that's
which
true.
Which is, of course, you know, that whole communism, Cold War stuff.
And warriors, well, yeah, once there's no war, that's a big adjustment.
Yeah.
You just can't be a farmer.
And that scene, there's a scene where Spock is asking Kirk if they've outlived their usefulness. Was originally actually Nimoy asking Shatner the same thing.
Well, and the last part, the last very words of this movie is where Kirk does the final, you know, this is the further voyages of the Starship, or the final cruise of the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And he says, to boldly go where no man, where no one has gone before.
And that's, of course, where Next Generation starts off, is their opening is where no one has gone before.
Exactly. And that was kind of a big deal.
Yeah. Because, you know, the ambassador, you know, when the daughter makes the point, you know, human rights, just, you know, inalienable. Just those two words are, like, just repugnant.
Oh, yeah. And it is. It's dismissive and you know, and Kirk at the end says to Spock, hey, look, everybody's human. Spock's like, I actually kind of find that offensive.
Yeah, F you. Yeah, no, you take your human and your, you know, I'll just stick it in your katra.
Exactly.
So Shatner says, quote, I was so relieved not to direct this film.
I'm sure.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Well, no, directing's hard work, apparently.
Yeah, but, and Plummer, Christopher Plummer said, his quote, he had a great quote. He had actually quite a lot of great lines, but he said, I know of no actor who wouldn't rather be a villain than be a charming leading man. If I always get a villain part offered to me, I will take that over any leading man part.
It seems like it would be totally fun.
But Plummer initially turned down the role because he wanted a really distinctive difference if he was going to do a Klingon, which is why all of the Shakespeare came in. And as Nick was helping write the script, he said it really grounded the movie into a relatable history because having the Shakespeare kind of makes it timeless in a way.
And all the Shakespeare quotes are about war and the nature of existence and, you know, everything they're facing.
And I guess the worst part of filming in this movie was that when they were out on the glacier, there wasn't snow. So they had to bring fake snow with them, which they thought was ridiculous in Alaska, but they had to anyway. But the problem was that it would be 22 below when they would start, but it would be 50 degrees by the time they were done because the sun would come up. And all the, you know, the light refraction, I guess it caused all kinds of problems with the sets and the outfits and the fake snow, which was part styrofoam and part soap flake, and was getting in everybody's ears and eyes.
Did you know that in the, I think it's the Glendale Mall outside of Los Angeles, they do a thing every year for like Christmas where they have like a snow day, and that they have these big machines that do shaved soap. And apparently, unless you're looking at the machinery, it looks a lot like snow falling, but it's soap. So it's like, oh man.
Well, it was always soap flakes, you know, back in the days of the old, you know, the actual movies and the old television, old time television. You know, it was snowflakes when they had live television in the 50s, you know, when they were trying to do snow. So it seems like snowflakes would be a, you know, a certain temperature, they're going to melt.
Well, yeah. I mean, and people end up with a mouthful of soap because people find it difficult to resist putting, like, lifting their head up and poking their tongue out as if it were real snow.
Which is fine if it's, you know, doesn't have a taste, I suppose. But if it's, you know, like zest or ivory or, it's going to, I imagine it's going to taste pretty awful.
Well, I don't know.
Having had a parent that didn't wash our mouth out with soap, though, I'm, you know, I don't know. I haven't tasted much soap in my life.
Yeah, perhaps we've come long ways from the day where soap was simply suet and lye, you know, but still. Ew.
Lye. It just makes me think of Fight Club.
Well. So, anything else about Star Trek? We have done a six-week marathon of Star Trek movies.
No, I don't think I have much to say about this point. I will say that I do have the Next Generation movies, and there's four of them. I have five discs. One of the discs is a bunch of extra added features. So I do have the four on Blu-ray. So maybe next year at the anniversary, or God forbid if there's another death.
Yeah, well, it'd have to be a Next Generation death, right?
Well, except that, I mean, Shatner was in the first movie of The Next Generation, as was Church Takei, I believe.
Huh. Well, yeah, I don't know. I know I saw at least a couple of those movies, if not them all.
I've seen all of them, but none of them are particularly memorable. I was reading the synopsis of them, and I'm like, I remember one of them. I don't remember the other three. And I know I've seen them. I mean, I've watched all of them, but like, they're in no way as memorable to me as the first generation. And maybe that's because the Next Generation movies, I probably haven't watched as much because I have, at that point, I had so much more stuff to watch. But, you know, I've seen the original six Star Trek movies, with the exception of Star Trek V. I've seen those first movies, you know, easily a dozen times apiece. But those were also the days where, you know, I didn't have a lot of movies to watch because you either had to rent them for a day, you know, for $3 a pop, or you had to buy, you know, you had to buy a VHS cassette for $80, which, you know, I never had in me. I never bought a VHS movie.
Oh, when they came down in price, I bought a couple of VHS things, but yeah, well, they were few and far between.
When they started being like $19, but at that point, then it was DVDs. And the DVDs were only $25-$30. And I was like, my little logic brain was like, I can get a physical tape that's going to break for $20, or I can get a DVD that's probably going to last me 30 years and, you know, for $10. And it was worth it.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to rewind a DVD. Okay.
It's nice if you do, though.
It is, yes. Another thing to think about, even though our calendar is, I think, pretty much stocked for several months, but eventually we need to go back to Bond, shouldn't we?
Yeah, we can whenever you want to.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, because I haven't seen some of the Bond movies.
It really matters how you want to approach Bond, if you want to start at the beginning. I mean, it's totally up to you, because I have all of them.
Well, we'd have to do it in sections, because I don't want to just start at the beginning and go for 6 months doing Bond movies.
I mean, we could do one a month if you wanted to do that.
Maybe. Yeah, that might be a good idea.
But, And I can give you a list of the ones I have, and so they're in the proper order.
Okay. Yeah, why don't you make a list of how the order that you want to tackle them in, which may be chronological.
And then do you want to tackle the Sean Connery Casino Royale, which was not Bond, but kind of Bond?
But you mean Peter Sellers? Or do you mean you mean the Sean Connery James Bond that wasn't a Broccoli production?
Yes, both.
Okay. Yeah, whatever. I mean, we can do all those.
Okay, I'll have to take a look. I'll take a look.
Yeah. I mean, because now coming off of a big round of Star Trek, I'm looking forward to the one-shots. Like, I'm already halfway through next week's movie. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.